Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Right now, I'd like to welcome Bill Hutchison. He is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, and this is our monthly animal segment. Welcome.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Good morning. Good. How are your doggies and kitties?
They're doing very good. I'm more and more conscious of, I just had a birthday, and when I have a birthday, it means my dog has a birthday also. Really, she was born about the same time I was.
You're twins.
And, I'm a little bit older. But, she turned 11 and my little dog just turned 11. And I'm more and more aware of how much older they're getting. The little dog at 11 is in a different shape than the very large dog at 11. And when you see them start slowing down, you become very conscious of the fact that these are dear, dear friends who you have for a very, very short time.
That is so true. And because their life cycle is so much shorter than ours, they're just a teacher of mortality, ours and others.
Yeah, absolutely. And the interesting thing, I think, about being a teacher of mortality is that you become a teacher of the full life also. There's a certain immediacy that you have to have as a creature who lives the way they do. And that's yet another of the fine and free good lessons you get from your animal friends.
Who knew that we'd wax so philosophical so early?
Yeah, that just kind of came out of nowhere, didn't it?
Indeed it did. We're here to talk about more mundane things like the fact that winter is cold.
Winter is cold, and you know that winter is cold, and your dog and your cat know that winter is cold also. It's very, very important as the weather starts to get cold for us to get more and more conscious of the fact that it's easy sometimes, and I think we get it maybe from... I don't know, those of us who grew up rurally, I had this belief for a long time that animals were kind of impervious to cold, didn't feel pain, the sort of the dumb brutes, the Cartesian mechanism, you know, just kind of ticking along until it stopped ticking.
Clearly you didn't have a short-haired terrier.
I did not have a short-haired terrier. But having the animals that I've had since then, and, you start to realize that, yes, indeed, animals get quite cold outside. Watch your water bowls. This is a good time to start making sure that if your dog is outside during the day, that the water bowl is not frozen. We have some water bowls on an outdoor cat area. We don't have any cats out there right now at the shelter, but we did have these water bowls out there, and one of the kennel techs brought it by this morning to my office and showed me, indeed, frozen solid 2 inches of water from last night. So that doesn't thaw out enough during these cold days for your animal to get a good drink. But at night, you know, it's hard a lot. Some folks don't want to bring them inside, but outside living is rough. It is rough for our dogs. Some dogs can do it in some parts of the country. Our winters here get pretty serious, even for a long-haired dog.
So what do you think about people who leave their dogs outside? Is it okay to leave a long-haired dog outside your house, let's say in a yard or whatever, during this season, during the winter season?
I think the most is it... Ask me the question again. Is it all right?
Is it okay to leave your long-haired dog outside?
There's just not a yes or no answer to that. But what I will give you is the honest and more complicated answer, which is... Some dogs can endure the temperatures outside better than other dogs. Certain breeds can. But there also has to be a way for your dog to get out of the wind, for it to still have water. I mean, the law is pretty clear on this matter. The law says your dog can be outside provided it has adequate shelter, food, and water.
That's the Santa Fe Animal Ordinance?
Yeah, essentially. That's the basic welfare of the Animal Ordinance. But, we know that the law is a baseline and that our ethical guideline has to be quite a bit higher than that, especially for any creature that can suffer because of what we do or do not do. And so can your animal be outside? Will it live? Will it be emotionally scarred for life? It'll probably be okay. But... that's where the question comes in, is our obligation to the animals that we choose to be responsible for to make them just be okay, or do we have to hold ourselves to a higher standard?
Or do we have to spoil the living heck out of them?
I think, it's absolutely nothing wrong with spoiling the living heck out of them. Normally, I would suggest the middle path, but with our animals, you don't necessarily have to walk the middle path. You can go completely crazy.
Yeah, I mean, animals aren't children. You can't spoil children, but you can totally spoil your little dogs.
Can. But even if you don't want to spoil them, I myself, much to my animal's chagrin, am not a spoiler. Like, I really love them, but You know, we have a certain minimum standard of decency, and you have to be upheld to that. But they, I think there's a, they enjoy that. They enjoy the interaction with a person, whether that interaction is being spoiled or, you know, being rigid. You can sit on that chair, and not that chair. Okay, fine, maybe you can sit on that chair. Those kind of things are, those are the richer things that we get, that if you elevate that standard, if you give them more than what is basically required, some of the amazing things that come of that.
One thing that I think is really important to talk about when we're talking about letting animals survive in the winter in Santa Fe, in the cold, is that animals in nature and the ancestors of dogs, coyotes, and wolves, especially wolves, have, you know, coats that keep them warm, but they also move about. They're hunting. They're running from one place to another. They're not sitting on a cement slab in your yard in the sun.
That's it. Yeah, that cement slab, I don't know, if you put your hands on a cement slab at midnight and it's freezing cold, and you put your hands on it at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and it's still freezing cold.
But even a little wooden porch or something like that, they're not moving. They don't have, unless you've got a ranch, they do not have the capacity to really move around the way a dog in nature would, or
yeah,
a wolf.
No, that's absolutely true. And I think the wild animal conversation is a good one, because I think a lot of folks who might say that an animal doesn't need to come inside might also say, like, animals survive in the wild. Well, indeed, animals freeze to death in the wild. It's not uncommon. It's one of the ways that natural selection kind of plugs along and does what it does. The difference with the animals that we have is they are no less susceptible. An animal that's a wild animal that's very, very cold and hungry is not any happier than your dog who is cold and hungry. The difference is with cats and dogs, we interfered with natural selection a long time ago. So to imagine that you might write off your obligation to an animal because animals in the wild survived completely forgets the fact that we've domesticated them. We've made them inextricably linked to ourselves. They cannot survive without us.
Now, I have to tell a little story, which is that the reason I have my little dog, Honey, who is a short-haired terrier, is because she was in a family that lived nearby that had three big, long-haired dogs that lived outside, and they made Honey live outside, too. And the other three dogs were fine, and Honey was absolutely freezing. So she dug a hole under the fence and came into my house, and she figured out when we had the door open, she came running in, she ate my then other dog's dog food, she slept on my bed, and she was happy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as a result, over the long run, when the family moved, I acquired Honey, and they kept their other three big dogs, and Honey's illegitimate puppies, but anyway, that's another story.
Yeah.
But the extent to which she was suffering from the cold in the winter cannot be overstated.
Yeah, I totally agree. There, you know, there are a lot of folks we're talking today. I was talking with one of my colleagues at work. There are dogs that that never come inside. They say live in a barn, work on a ranch, that are very, very happy dogs their whole lives. But the very, very happy dogs that live that way do have usually a nice warm barn to sleep in, a garage to sleep in. There is some kind of inside, some kind of not abandoned to the elements, a factor to that that makes it a very functional relationship between human and animal. But you're right, there's just, and it's amazing what dogs and cats can endure. I have seen some stunning, stunning moments of survival. And a dog can live for a long time, sometimes its whole life, living like that. But the quality of life as compared to an animal who we are more mindful to the temperatures and the various things going on in the environment that we can intervene with, that animal is just going to have a much higher quality of life. And we will be directly responsible for reducing part of the suffering in the world.
Now, in the kind of situation that I had many years ago when Honey came to me, it was an awkward situation. In a sense, because they were the neighbors, although they were great people, I liked them, but they were really not treating this animal well. Now, it all worked out because Honey came to be my little dog, but in the case of somebody who doesn't want to adopt the neighbor's dog or can't adopt the neighbor's dog, or the neighbor doesn't want them to adopt the dog, but you see that there is something bordering on animal abuse going on, or outright animal abuse.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do?
You have a couple of options. If the situation is pretty ugly, then you can call city animal services or county animal control to file a report, and they can do a welfare check to check on the status of the animal. And if the animal's found lacking in some of the basic requirements by the law, then they can cite them, and legal measures can begin. But the basics level of care is sometimes less than perhaps... I may feel like what the law asks me to accept is far too little, that they need more as a basic minimum standard. So what do you do when you know they need more, you don't have the law on your side, and your neighbor doesn't want to have this conversation? This is a question we get a lot, and it's not a question... I'm beginning to suspect it's not a question I'm ever going to have a very good answer to, because I really don't know. There are those who would say you have an obligation to make a fuss with your neighbor until the situation changes, to advocate on behalf of the animal. But what I've seen a lot of the times is that produces a tremendous resistance to changing the mindset of the person. If I'm telling you how it's going to be, how you got to be, and I'm telling you in such a way that that I have to accept you totally undermining my dignity as a person to accept what you're saying, then a lot of people are very resistant to that. And it
doesn't. So in other words, if you come off as a pompous know-it-all dog-owning neighbor...
Yeah, you're serving neither the animal nor the person in that situation. And worse, you may be creating a resistance for that individual to change the way that they behave. Does that mean you don't say anything, you just treat your animals really well and hope they notice? I don't
that
know.
Doesn't
this
work.
Is hard. Like, it's really, really hard. You have to be clear on why you're saying what you're saying. If you're saying something to them because you're mad at them or because they're being big jerks, as you say that, no matter how you say that, if that's what's inside, that's what's going to come out. And you lose the ability to really interact with that person and advocate for that animal. So if there's an approach, I don't know that there's a way to do what you're saying, but an approach is to stay really open. Understand that people don't know until they know, and they don't know what they don't know. And you can have gentle conversations and try and be really patient. And yes, in the interim, the animal is outside and it is suffering, but as we talked about earlier, an animal can endure a lot, and if it takes a while to get the right thing done, that's better than the right thing never being done at all. It's complicated.
Have you
it's done? Really
have
hard.
You been in that situation where you have told people, "I think that your animal is not happy, and you could do this and that"?
Many, many times.
And what?
Many,
how do you do times. It? I mean, you're a good communicator.
A lot of it depends on the receptivity. You can say the same words to two different people, and depending on their receptivity and your delivery, you can have two vastly different results. What I try to do is really imagine. Do my best to very quickly figure out who this person is and where they're at, and if there's a way that I can talk to them that's really human and honest and not... If you try and protect the animal only, and in protecting the animal, you aggress toward the human, you are not doing a great job of protecting the animal. It doesn't serve the long term. You know, there's a really long view on animal welfare. You do have to speak up if you see something wrong happening, and I know it doesn't sound
example.
Like I'm not advocating. An example of...
Out of your life where you have given unsolicited advice to a complete stranger about their animal.
The best way to get into it, and I had this with a neighbor. I lived in Chimayo for a long time, and I had a situation with a neighbor whose dog was always on a chain, and he loved that dog, but that dog was always on a chain and always had a doghouse, but always had a chain. And the dog was not unhappy. He was happy when the guy came and petted him, but he was alone, completely alone the rest of the day, completely alone in a maybe a 10-foot circle, and it was unbearable to see. And I knew just because of who this guy was that some young punk telling him how he ought to treat his dog was not going to go well for anybody. So I just started talking to him about his dog because we both really liked the dog, and that was the best place to start. The thing that I knew without a doubt we had in common was that we both really liked this dog. And so we talked about his dog a lot over the course of 2 or 3 weeks, and then we started talking about my dog, and he asked where I kept my dog at night because I didn't have a garage and he didn't see it outside. And then we started talking about how my dog slept inside, and she had a nice little bed in the sunroom, and it was really great. And his mind was boggled that I kept my dog in the sunroom. But more and more we talked about it, and it became very clear that it was a natural thing for me to want to have this companion I liked inside with me. he didn't want to have the dog outside because he didn't want the dog to come inside. He wanted the dog outside because, in his mind, dogs lived outside. But he really liked this dog, and to slowly get this idea that it was okay to have the dog inside, which is where the dog and he both wanted the dog to be anyway, was a huge moment for him. And that was kind of an easy one.
Because did it happen? Did
oh, yeah, the, yeah, 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 yeah.
He let the dog inside.
They were into it. The dog rides around with him in his truck. I still see him in town a lot.
He took the dog off the chain.
Yeah, and this was not, but this was, one should say that when you advocate for an animal, like, you don't get to pat yourself on the back at the end of this. Bill didn't do anything great.
Yes, you did.
No, 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 the dog does this. The dog does the real work of this. The animal is the one that tends to do the real work of this, because it was that dog's sort of just endless loving devotion to a guy who was doing something that he didn't, the dog wasn't necessarily into it, but he, the dog was into his person, and the person was into his dog, and they got to see that in each other. That's a fabulous moment. Not
yeah, but
everybody's
if, but
that.
But if you hadn't had that conversation and that series of conversations, and if you hadn't been the good communicator that you are, the dog would probably still be on the chain.
Some other good animal lover would have done.
But the point is, it took human intervention.
You do have an obligation to speak up, but part of that obligation is to do it in a way that is. That is just as kind to the person as you're trying to be to the animal. That if you decrease the amount of compassion or caring that you're giving, that you have in mind toward the animal to the person, if you're not doing that, then you're gonna tend to do a less effective job of really advocating for that animal in a way that will
yeah.
change its life and how that human interacts with animals henceforth.
I heard a little catchphrase the other day: "To err is human; to forgive is canine."
Right. Totally true. Absolutely. And you're allowed to make mistakes. I was talking with a colleague the other day that it's hard with animals. It's hard to bear the guilt of knowing you wronged an animal, because if I wrong you, Mary Charlotte, I can apologize and you can say genuinely that it's okay. But if I wrong an animal somehow, like, the forgiveness is instantaneous, but I don't ever get to ask for that apology. And it's very interesting. It changes the way I think we can be obligated to the animals, to live in a way that we don't ever have to feel like we need to make an apology that's impossible to make.
Dog love means never having to say you're sorry.
Amen. Allie would agree with that 100%.
We're talking to Bill Hutchison of the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. So what's going on at the shelter these days? What particular challenges do you face in the winter months?
Right now we started talking about this a couple of years ago, this strange change in cats across the country, that where animal shelters would show reduced intake of cats during the winter months because they're not breeding as much. Winter months are showing the same levels of intake as the summer months. This was bizarre and freakish and terrifying the first year.
Totally global warming.
A little weird. That's a lot of people.
I'm just kidding.
Anecdotally are saying that in animal welfare. Admittedly, these are people with animal backgrounds, not necessarily environmental science backgrounds.
I'm totally kidding. How can that possibly
be?
No.
This is a conversation, because a few degrees difference changes the length of the breeding season. So if you're able to breed, it's the same way we have a long growing season in New Mexico, because climatologically we get more sun and warmth longer than, say, Minnesota does. So if you have this change where the warm season can extend just a little bit longer, then you have that just a little bit longer times massive numbers of animals without homes means you get a lot more offspring, and they find a way to just keep going.
So that's what you're seeing at the shelter, a lot of cats?
A lot of cats. We're going to, after the holidays...
Are they kittens?
A lot of kittens. That's kittens and adult cats. It's both. We're also seeing big increases in owner surrenders, which I think is because of people's fear of the economy crashing. Some of it perceived fear, and some of it real things that are happening to people who are falling on hard times. So,
well, the price of gas went back down. You can put that extra amount of gas money into your cat kibble.
Yeah, we talked about this on our last show, that that, you know, there's a certain amount that is unavoidable and a certain amount that's avoidable depending on where you place your priorities. But we have a lot of cats. If you are a cat lover or would like to learn to be a cat lover, I guarantee you we have a cat that will teach you. And we really, really need to find homes for them. This is happening all over the country. Animal shelters are full of cats, and avenues to get them out of there, like transferring them to other shelters that might be low on cats, isn't happening because everybody's got more cats than they can handle.
So if anybody wants to give somebody they love, especially a small person, a young person, a kitty cat for Christmas, this would be a great time.
Yes, we like it when people think about animals around the holidays. It's The gift is not the animal, of course. The animal's not a thing you can give somebody. But the gift is knowing that you've done something pretty superb, which is to give a creature that can live 15, 20 years a permanent home for the rest of its life. That's a nice gift. Plus, then you don't have to get it anything for the rest of its life. No.
Wait, what
presents.
Do you mean the cat's not a gift? I got a dog for my 6th birthday.
Yeah, I'm going to make this all boring and lame by saying there's a philosophical approach to the idea of giving an animal as a gift. It's a relationship that you enter into. And I think that we discourage people from coming and picking out a cat and giving it to their friend for Christmas, because there's a whole set of decisions that one needs to make before you take on the what's a pretty serious 15 to 20 year commitment of an animal. So we tend to decline people who want to get an animal for someone else. But if you want to come in with your friend and fork over the adoption fee and let them pick an animal, see who jives with them, etc. Because the cat that picks you is not necessarily the cat that picks your best chum.
So you don't give them out with curly bows on the collar?
Negatory. Although if you want to supply your own curly bow, nary an animal shelter employee will stand in your way.
Do you lower your standards when you've got that many animals?
No, what we try to do is lower our adoption rates. Lowering our standards is a funny question. In other words,
somebody comes in and says, I want to give my little brother or my friend or whatever this sweet little kitty for Christmas, and you say no, and you've got all these kitties there that are going
to... Oh, I don't think you can say no. I think you can encourage them strongly to bring their friend in, and I think that's the answer. The answer is not, no, your friend can't have a cat. The answer is, your friend gets to have the cat that they pick, and that's a considerably more off... If you look at the presents that you will get this holiday season, and look at the gifts that you are given with unsolicited information, how many of those are exactly what you wanted, and how many of those are, I'll have to get this out when Aunt Helen comes to visit next fall. Picking the animal that you are going to commit to is a big deal. This is maybe perhaps one of the problems with arranged marriages. Arranged adoptions are kind of the same problem.
Bill Hutchison, you put the humane back in Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. You put the K back in KSFR.
That doesn't mean anything.
I know. I know. It was the best I could come up with on short notice. I didn't have time to write anything for that part of the segment.
Anything else that you want to let people know about before we go? This is our last animal segment before the holidays.
It is. You can always look at our adoptable animals on our website. And our website is a great way to really keep an eye and see who strikes your fancy before you come in. Website is www.sfhumanesociety.org. If you ever have any questions or want to know something that Mary Charlotte or I don't answer on our animal segment, you can always email me. My email address is bhutchison@sfhumanesociety.org. Or you can just give me a call at the shelter, 983-4309. I always like hearing what people have to say.
983-4309 is the number over there, and it's a wonderful place, and the community really pitched in to build this new shelter. It used to be over on Cerritos Road. Now it's just on the outskirts of town, and it's a fabulous facility run by, humane people.
Yeah, it used to be a ramshackle 70-year-old house on Cerritos Road. And if you haven't seen it, we moved out there in the summer of 05. If you haven't seen it, we don't make you adopt if you come out, but it's a pretty astonishing...
That would shelter, be unconstitutional.
Exactly. The shelter is really a big, giant monument to what this town puts into animal welfare. This town gave us the $10 million in $5 and in $50,000 chunks to build that thing, and it's pretty astonishing.
Bill Hutchison, it's wonderful to have you. We'll see you in January. Have a great holiday.
Happy New Year, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Richard Camp. He is the director of eTech International. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
eTech International, an interesting group that does projects in third world countries, and the tech is about basically technical assistance. Tell us about this organization.
Well, eTech provides on behalf of people in poor countries and often in very impoverished and isolated communities the tools to deal with the technical and often very harsh impacts, environmental impacts of major industrialization projects, oil, gas, refineries, mines, smelters. And
so basically, if somebody is living in South America, the Amazon rainforest, somewhere like that, and there is an oil drill. There's oil drilling, and they are compromised. You actually come in and help them?
Yeah, we work at the request of communities, mostly in South America, but more recently in Africa also. And on behalf of other groups, they can be environmental groups, they can be groups like Oxfam, that work internationally on a combination of human rights and environmental issues, natural resource issues. And what we tend to do is try and deal with the nuts and bolts problems that are on the ground that people have no information on. So if you have a massive oil gas project or a large mine, this can be new, this can be old. It's rare that you have campaigns that are dealing with these types of issues that also have, you know, the real technical information on what the impacts of these projects are.
Actually go there with measurement equipment,
yes,
and provide data.
Well, it depends. You know, it depends on the financing. It depends on what you can do. You adjust what you can do to the budget and to the situation. We work some places that are, you know, dangerous. Most places that are in poor, relatively corrupt countries. And in the end, we try and provide as much information as possible. If we're able to go and take, you know, today we just had a geologist returning from northern Peru from the Corrientes region, where he's actually been doing sampling of oil cleanups from Occidental Petroleum. And, you know, we're awaiting those results to be able to measure what he's seen with his eyes. In other cases, we're looking at the mining impacts in Guatemala of, you know, a mine that's been very controversial and has led to death threats and a lot of fighting within the community. And we're trying to develop a means, long-term means, to do monitoring that can be accepted by a bunch of parties from, you know, theoretically the mine. That's on behalf of, you know, we have some help from Oxfam America, some from the Catholic Church, and some from a U.S. foundation. So it varies a lot. Generally, you're dealing with very poor conditions, but you're trying to keep in mind, I mean, the perspective of this is that we're looking for practical political solutions, but we're trying to be what you might call, we're trying to do skeptical technical due diligence. Okay, if you were a bank, you know, you'd be calling
technical due diligence.
Yeah, you'd be calling on a consultant, and that consultant would almost automatically be trying to provide you information that's going to be favorable to a project. This is true of a company too.
So if you have a situation where there was a mine and then there's also sorts of toxicity that's affecting a community, in order for there to be a political response about that, there has to be data about who's being harmed, how much parts per million there is in the drinking water, that kind of thing?
In many respects, yes. And the difference is that what you tend to get are several types of technical reports. You'll get white papers. Somebody will come in and say, this is the problem. And then that's it. Second, you're going to have what's going to show up in an environmental impact statement or assessment for a government that is done generally by the company and their non-skeptical consulting firm. And the third thing you're going to have, and this is the most common, you're going to hear from a non-governmental organization and their allies, they're going to be protesting horrible things that are going on. And what you're going to lack, usually, is the willingness. I think as far as I know, we're unique, and we're trying to make alliances with as many groups, governments, and agencies as we can. We're trying to come in there, look at what the problem is. What are people getting affected by? What are the politics? What's the reality of this country? What's the reality of this town? You know, in Guatemala, the military has shifted from killing Indians to moving drugs. You know, what are the dangers that people face? And on top of that, what are the parts per million of water, of air? What are they breathing? What are the health problems showing up? How do you monitor long term? How do you get something going? Where can you actually get some traction to solve a problem that exists or to prevent problems? For example, in the case of oil gas, we're working with the MacArthur Foundation and a lot of groups in Peru to try and work on both monitoring of existing problems. It's one I just mentioned in northern Peru in the Corrientes region. The Camisea Natural Gas Project, where we're trying to develop independent monitoring, any kind of environmental monitoring.
That's in Peru.
That's in Peru still. And in the past, we were able to get enough information internally from company sources to predict where a pipeline that was less than 2 years old would break six times, and it did. But third, we're also trying to look at the best oil gas practices where President Garcia, previously convicted of embezzlement, president again, is giving away the Amazon and many other areas, giving away oil concessions and mining concessions. So in Peru, where can you get best practices where companies can drill from 20 miles away, extended reach drilling, instead of entering into an indigenous or a reserve or other protected area? I mean, those are examples of, trying to deal with the reality and trying to prevent future realities where, you can't fight the fact that these concessions may have been given away, which is another front.
Now, you have, in that example, a leader of a country who is giving away the country. You have oil companies who are very powerful and have all the science and technical and engineering personnel that they could possibly want. And then you've got you, Richard Camp of ETEC International, showing up with, a ruler and,
No, I think here's the main thing that we're skipping. Who is ETEC? ETEC right now is three principals. I'm a guy who's coordinating stuff. I'm not a scientist. I'm not an engineer. I've got an incredibly fine scientist, Ann Mace, who's an aqueous geochemist, and Bill Powers, who's a utility engineer. We, in turn, when we do get the money, have other really great consultants who we bring in. For example, our geologist, Mark Quarles, who came back from Corrientes today on MacArthur money. Other times, we will be looking for any people that, say, World Wildlife already have in the field. Or we'll be going to the Dutch government, with whom we have an alliance from their environmental commission that is part of their government, and we'll try and get them to intervene. We'll promote their intervention. We'll try and look at whatever's practical. So it's usually not Dick Camp with a ruler. If we're going to do it...
I was exaggerating.
No, but it's a really good example because, we are basically... Our infrastructure is very simple. And we maintain day jobs. As you know, I'm a reporter on the side. And, we all try and ensure that if we're going to do something, we're doing it with the type of credibility that could match any peer review from anybody, academic, government, industry.
So you have very accurate reports, but nevertheless, you are up against, in terms of the, not so much the science, but the politics, you're up against some very strong forces. Who are your allies? Are they all international non-government organizations such as Oxfam International?
It's been a real mix. In Guatemala, we certainly hope that in addition to the Catholic Church, which is a very controversial type of an ally, that we will have a weak government that we can help carefully strengthen. It's walking on kind of scary eggshells there. We don't yet know what's going to be the most useful thing to do. So, for example, in the case of Guatemala, I can't tell you any more than I can tell funders. In the case of Peru, we've got enough of a track record. We've been in headlines in the paper. We've been controversial enough that by trying to bring together government agencies, there's, for example, an ombudsman, a human rights ombudsman. We're trying to get them.
What is an ombudsman? I just learned that not too long ago.
An ombudsman is, can be in a college. It can be somebody who helps students deal with the administration.
But it's
in Latin America, it's a mediation type of function. But it's basically representing usually those people that are being affected by something rather than those people that are perpetrating something.
Right.
So, it's in Peru, the projects really differ with what we're doing. In one case, we're representing the Achuar Indians. This is the Corrientes area and their cleanup.
And what is it that they're cleaning up again?
They're cleaning up, 40 years of Occidental Petroleum dumping oil and oil gas wastes on their territory. And, we helped develop the plan in cooperation with Plus Petrol, which is taken over as the current, Latin American oil company, to clean up. Now, this is a complex process, but there the allies are, the government's glad to see this maybe taken care of. I think Occidental was really delighted to have the opportunity to walk away from massive lawsuits or international courts of law. It really changes. In Ecuador, where we've worked on you know, the Chevron dumping case and the, you know, leftover from Texaco's operations in the northeast of Peru, of Ecuador. Well, we now have a sympathetic government. Rafael Correa has, you know, been a thoughtful, educated, you know, often ally, whereas before, you know, 10 years ago, I think if we had entered into it, we would have met hostility.
Right.
So it varies. If we work in Bolivia, where there's no money, but we've had requests, I don't know where Evo Morales comes down and all this stuff, you know. Socialists aren't always the best environmentalists.
We're talking to Richard Camp, director of eTech International. So what about local activist groups in the areas that are affected? Are they well organized? Do you work with them?
In the case of the Indians in North Peru, yes. In the case of other areas, it's been rare. We always work with everybody. I mean, the irony of this is we began this around 9/11 when the stock market was crashing then too and things were in chaos. And we realized if we were going to start a nonprofit, you know, there were three of us with about 70 years experience working internationally in nonprofits, that we damn well better be cooperating with as many people as possible. We can't be competing for limited funds. And that's how we've worked, and that's why we've succeeded, is that, you know, we don't always follow the advice of what everybody thinks, but we consult a lot with everybody who is being affected by our working on these projects. You know, we take note of where they're fighting with each other, because nonprofits in third world countries always try and kill each other. So, you know, our role, I think, is to try and provide something that seems like it can work under the circumstances. That limits a lot of what you do.
How does it limit what you do?
Well, aside from the fact that money isn't there frequently, you feel like, okay, if there's a whole lot of struggle going around among different forces in civil society itself, and, you know, we're just going to be viewed with suspicion, let's just ride this out and wait. We're not straining at the bit to take new projects. It's generally been that we get a lot of requests. We spend a lot of time, usually unpaid, trying to figure out what to do with it. And then we try and see if we can get funding to work with it. And currently, you know, we're funded to be working in Peru and in Guatemala and in several areas in Peru and to do assessments. Probably the most interesting one to compare to the U.S. is Ann Mace, who's one of my partners in this, did a study for a group called Earthworks in the United States that looked at U.S. mines on federal lands that under the process called NEPA, where if you're going to be approved under federal land, you have to demonstrate you're not going to pollute in the United States, Forest Service, anything else, BLM. And she and an associate did a study that showed that 73% of all U.S. mines approved since the late 1980s, new mines, violated the Clean Water Act.
Right.
Oxfam essentially has, you know, given us a grant to be looking at this globally. And two mines in absolutely impoverished, the poorest people imaginable in Mali and Ghana, gold mines there, as well as the Yanacocha, a giant mine that Ann's worked on in Peru, and the Marlin mine. We're trying to look at what they said they would do, and whatever available information we can get shows, did they pollute or didn't they? And what information is available, and what can people get their hands on, and how can they get any kind of response?
So in these very poor countries, and it turns out that the gap between what they said they would do and what they did do is a very large gap.
Generally.
Then the next step is?
The next step is going to vary by each country. In Peru, there's a very well-organized civil society. And there would be responses.
With more than semi-functional justice system?
That's a good question, because the justice system in Peru has been monstrous. I don't know. It was definitely a step up from where it was, but not functional, a couple of years ago. And I haven't been involved in any justice, you know, any legal cases there. Ecuador, for example, that remains to be seen.
But when you say that they have a civil society, what
is civil society?
No, how does that help actions to be taken when you've got this gap between how much they were supposed to pollute, which was not at all, and how much they did?
The one thing you do have in Latin America, for example, and I can't answer a lot of questions about Africa. We worked in Nigeria, but it's still a bit foreign, is squeaky wheels.
Right.
El grito, the scream, you know, brings
the more you complain,
response.
The more response
you complain,
there is.
The more you can complain, you know, in Peru it's very easy to get access to the press. it's very easy off for us also to get access to the press in the United States. So, you know, in the case of a larger issue like the mine in Peru we're looking at, you know, based on what we do, if we do have noteworthy information, we can get an audience. And groups can get a response from government because this is a major issue in Peru. Now, what do you get in Guatemala? I don't know. I think that, you know, in Guatemala, it's as if we're entering the first stage. Nobody's really done this in Guatemala. It's new to have any serious industrial development. It's even newer to have any response that's anything other than, you know, fear and hatred. You know, it's an area that in which genocide still forms the way people respond, which is to presume that, you know, the people who are there, they're fighting would kill them. And the death threats are rampant. So, I mean, what is it that they will get? I don't know. And I think we'll enter into this, you know, carefully.
Another thing that you are working on is low-carbon alternatives for San Diego and Tijuana, the border area there. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that project.
Well, that's an outgrowth of a group that several of us were involved in previously called the Border Power Plant Working Group and a project of the San Diego Foundation, which is like the San Diego Community Foundation. In that particular project, ETEC, through Bill Powers, who's the utility engineer, has developed very, very concrete recommendations on how to proceed to apply solar, how to apply greatly improved distributed generation, local generation of electricity through photovoltaics, through discrete electrical generation projects, and dealing also with the movement back and forth that's going on with San Diego utilities and some of their allied companies to develop power on the Mexican side in Tijuana and to try and avoid more power lines and in its stead increase generation in San Diego by up to 40% of renewables by the year 2020. And to make this, again, a type of project that requires, you know, a public response. Is this real or is this not? And to date, you know, the response, which was first very angry by some of the larger privately owned utilities and very positive by the government of San Diego and Tijuana, has been, you know, we may be missing a few pieces of the equation, but I think the report is extremely well put together. And, you know, again, how much of this can be implemented or will be implemented may depend on a mix of, you know, Barack Obama and California, Schwarzenegger, and public and private money. That's obviously a very different, you know, milieu, medium to be working in terms of the politics.
What is the nature of the relationship between Tijuana and San Diego? Do they communicate well now? He was shaking his head.
It's the communications have long gone on, and I have 30 years of involvement in border, you know, mano a mano, shake hands, clap everybody on the back. I think the problem with Tijuana is, you know, there's a very high murder rate and a lot of drugs and narcos running things. The question of whether you can get, you know, alternative energy into this equation effectively, there's a very, very effective, very strong, very brilliant group of non-governmental organizations and individuals that are working out of Tijuana. I mean, really amazing people. And they've been at it for 25 years. So in terms of access to government versus access to money, they've got that. They've got the ear of the government. They've got cross-border communications. And the potential there is probably higher than anywhere else because you have so many brilliant minds working on this. And you've got California where, you know, you're going to have cutting-edge mistakes in trying to get alternative energy in
cutting
place.
Cutting-edge mistakes.
But you're going to also have cutting-edge policies. And that's a long other conversation.
So what else would you like to let, we've got about 2 minutes left, people know about ETEC International, besides the fact that they can be found on the web at etecinternational.org?
Which is a bit behind on some of the projects. I'll try and get it updated in the next month. I think for those who are seriously interested in providing technical support, we had one volunteer person in Santa Fe contact us already. We're interested in getting people who want to volunteer time because our budget is marginal. And
you get grants from foundations, and that is going down.
We never really got, you know, substantial grants from foundations until the stock market started to crash. And there's still some of the, you know, we have 3 years of commitments in Peru for $50,000 a year, and you can do the math on that. We are definitely open to donations from individuals. I know that there's very few foundations that fund international activities that are likely to be in the radio audience.
But if they are,
and if you're an individual and you're interested in supporting our work, I'm happy to talk with you and meet with you. Call me on my cell. That's the best number.
Which is?
670-1337. That number again.
670-1337.
Because I'm on the road a lot. And you can also reach me. My email's terrible, so I'm going to give you an alternative email, which is Camp Richard, K-A-M-P, Richard, at yahoo.com.
All right.
You can email me there. And, you know, we can certainly use any support. I mean, everything we have goes towards our programmatic work. That's not the best way to run a nonprofit. But
don't have big fancy offices with furniture.
We have people use their individual offices. I use a tiny office behind my house.
Yeah.
We have separate offices that are being utilized in Boulder, Colorado, and San Diego, California.
Well, I want to extend to you my admiration for the amazing work you do, and thank you for being on the Radio Cafe, Richard Camp.
Well, thanks a lot, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here again.
And we will see you soon.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. We will see you tomorrow. Have a wonderful day. Ciao.